Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah reigned. We don't mean to say that he may not have prophesied through all of their reigns. Altogether, it stretches out into a very long period. And we do not know whether these were given at different times. Probably they were, like Isaiah's or Jeremiah's prophecies. Many times you find that their prophecies were just sermons, forthtelling as well as foretelling. So it was, I would say, like Isaiah. Isaiah prophesied 60 or 70 years, and I would say that Hosea did the same. Hear the word of the Lord. How good is the word of the Lord. Now in your life you will meet people who are, well, they may be good people, but they'll be deceived. I had a man come to my place one time. We had just closed a revival meeting, and I was pastoring a very poor church. And he was a prophet. He insisted that I have him for a revival meeting. And I said, well, we just had one, and we're not able to finance another one. Okay, you had your chance. He was a prophet. And I had prophets come to me in Denver with their prophecies, and had a woman come to me, and she has the opinion that she's a prophet. And I'm not saying that the Lord doesn't bless them and help them, but, well, you get this spirit too often. There was a man holding a meeting for Brother Casey. I knew both men reasonably well. And Brother Casey had announced that the meeting was going to close at a certain time, and the man that was holding the meeting wanted it to go on. And Brother Casey wouldn't agree to it. And here's what he said. I'm a prophet and you're just a pastor. I have more authority than you have. I'd have been tempted to say, well, let's see about that. I knew a fellow from the West Coast. He said, I'm the king bee around here. I hadn't heard of a king bee before. But here was a man that could say, hear the word of the Lord, ye children of Israel. For the Lord hath a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, and he tells why. Because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. Some years ago, some friends of mine asked me to read a book. It's a novel. It's called The Shepherd of the Hills. Did you ever hear of it? And I've never forgotten a statement that he made in there toward the end of it. He said, we have churches, but we don't attend them. We have pastors, but we don't listen to them. We have Bibles, but we don't read them. Now, especially the latter part was true as far as Christendom is concerned, Bibles. And in our day, there is such a pressure to know everything else. To me, it's an amazing sight to go into a big drugstore to the book rack and see the enormous number of books that are there for entertainment. I never buy one of them, of course, but the public library in Tulsa kind of boasted that they had a reading program that if you took it through and read it, it would take you 100 years. Now you can see how the current of the times keeps you out of the Bible. There are certain radio programs that I just won't miss, people say. A friend of mine and I went to a woman's home one time to get ready for a funeral. He came from out of town and we met there. And that woman had a baseball game on, and she refused to turn that off while we practiced a song or what have you. I've forgotten what it was. And incidentally, she filled a prominent place in her church, the Baptist church. She died recently. I always liked her. She was a good woman. But you run into these things, and then here is the reason. Now, your mind is something like a quart fruit jar. Did you ever try to get a half a gallon of water in a quart fruit jar? No, I don't think you ever did. There is not room for it. Well, your mind is something like a fruit jar. It will contain so much. And you can't force it anymore. That's the limit. And if I allow too many other things, now we have to keep up. There's to a certain extent on some things, it is practically a necessity that we keep up on. But everything else now actually is secondary. Everything. The Lord has a controversy because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. It seems to me that there are several things God frowns on deeply, and one of them is lying. No truth. No mercy. Now, we're in a very much of a mechanical age. Just a kind of a merciless time. Appreciation isn't shown, and people are actually afraid to come to somebody's aid when they're in trouble. In fact, I heard on the radio or read that Minnesota had passed a law that now you see somebody being attacked for something, you're supposed to go in and help them. But too many times when it has been attempted, the party that went in to help paid the fine and not the person that was committing the crime. In the knowledge of God and the land, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. And the knowledge of God is important above any other knowledge. Now, in this day of high technology, it's difficult to keep up with some knowledge. It's increasing so fast. I read some years ago that knowledge was doubling every 15 years. We're in a great time of research throughout the world, and I have read that most of the scientists that have ever lived are alive today. But it's still a fact. Now, you stop and think about this, and I often think about it. Do you know why the Bible wasn't given until late? You see, the human race is 2,500 years old, according to the Bible, when Moses wrote. Who could have read it if God had written it? Who could write if God had wanted it written? The very earliest that any form of writing has been found that can be dated is 3,200 years before Christ, and they used pictures to represent ideas. And practically all alphabets of the day came from the Arabic, and they're so similar. Hebrew starts off with Aleph, A. Greek starts off with Alpha, A. English starts off with A. And what I started to say is that God produced some very fine saints, such, let's say, Isaac, Abraham, Melchizedek, and Enoch, and none of them could read or write, who we have any record of. They didn't have organs or songbooks or pianos. I'm glad we have those things. I wouldn't want to. Oh, I could run church without them, but I wouldn't want to. I've been in meetings in other parts of the world where there was one songbook or no songbooks. But you see, they had the knowledge of God. It was a direct revelation from God, not reading it out of the scriptures. So the knowledge of God and the right knowledge of God is the most important knowledge that there is. Now notice how many commandments are broken. The second verse, by swearing, that is false swearing, and lying, thou shalt not bear false witness, and killing, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and stealing, and committing adultery, thou shalt not commit adultery. They break out and blood toucheth blood, meaning one bloody crime follows another one. I mentioned a moment ago about the Italian town with 70 murders already this year from the mafia on the television tonight. Now, my sons, I don't have a television that's operable and haven't for the last 10 or 12 years. There's no sin in a television. It can surely take up a lot of good time. There's no sin in anything as far as material. There's no sin in a bottle of whiskey, but it'll make you sin. No sin in a gun, but you can sin with a gun. No sin in a couple of cubes that you'd call a paradise or a deck of cards, but it's the use that's made of that sin. That's the sin is in you. But here are the commandments, all broken. Like Moses broke them literally, they broke them by disobeying God. Five things he said they were doing: swearing, lying, killing, stealing, committing adultery. Therefore shall the land mourn, and everyone that dwelleth therein shall languish, and the beasts of the field with the fowls of the heaven, yea, the fishes of the sea also shall be taken away. Seemingly there was going to come a terrible famine and drought. And in Israel, we just have to read their histories to find out that the weather so frequently was attached to their conduct. In Elijah's day, you remember the famine, and then in Elisha's day, there was a seven-year famine. In the days of Ruth, the daughter of Boaz, her in-laws had gone to Moab because of a famine. Yet let no man strive nor reprove another, for thy people are as they that strive with the priest. Now, they were so bad that there was no point in reproving back and forth. They were all bad. Those that would strive with the priest, according to Deuteronomy 17:12, should be put to death. He was the judge, and if they wouldn't listen to him, they were the Supreme Court. Therefore shalt thou fall in the day, a time when you wouldn't expect it. The prophet also shall fall with thee in the night, and I will destroy thy mother, Israel. And the prophet here, of course, would be a false prophet. Now, we read a moment ago that there was no knowledge of God in the land. Now in verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And in the last part of the 14th verse, therefore the people that doth not understand shall fall. Man shall not live by bread alone. I preached Sunday night on why did God give the Bible. Among other reasons, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word. And there seems to be a time in life when promises are needed that perhaps we didn't know were in the book. I heard the testimony of a man who was captured by the communists when they took over in China. And he said they had interrogators and they made him sit on the edge of a tube for it, not the flat side, but the narrow side, for all day and questioned him. And he said during this time, God gave him statements from the scriptures that he didn't even know were there. He told how the communists said, so you believe in prayer, do you? Yes, sir, I do. Get down on your knees and pray and get an answer right now. And he told how he prayed and what happened. He said, Lord, if you have to strike this man blind to convince him that you exist, do so. And he said the man went blind like that. And he became a Christian. And the communists had their gentle way of getting rid of him. They took two chopsticks. You ever see chopsticks? They put one in each nostril and took a hammer and drove them up into his brain. Simple way to killing him. But God gave him scriptures for him to stand on that he had forgotten or hadn't read. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Store it up. Thy word have I hid in my heart. God gave you a memory. Isn't a memory a handy thing? Did you ever see anybody with amnesia? I knew a man that was injured in a car wreck, and his mind reverted to infancy. He was a married man with an educated man. He had had 5 years of college. His wife had had several more, and she told me he'd say to his father, I dis wovu, Daddy. Can you imagine that? A man that had been a teacher. Well, his memory just suddenly wasn't. He was brought out of it later. But the Lord gave you a memory. The ancients used to call the memory, the belly of the mind. Like we store food in our stomach. Well, we store knowledge in our memory. So store your memory with the Word of God. Commit it to memory. Because thou hast rejected knowledge, I also will reject thee. That thou shalt be no priest to me, seeing thou hast forsaken or forgotten the law of thy God, I will also forget thy children. Just retribution. As there were increased, so they sinned against me. In the time of one of the prophets of the kings that he mentioned, the man Jeroboam, he was Jeroboam II, it was a great time of prosperity in northern Israel. And instead of taking it as a blessing from God, and how often I have seen that, Jeshurun waxed fat and kicked. I don't think anybody here, maybe McClary's, may remember O.W. Webb. O.W. Webb was an extremely sharp businessman. He sold out his business and resigned his church and evangelized for 3 years. And he said he held a meeting in a place, a very fine church building, and he complimented the pastor on it. He said tears came into his eyes immediately. He said, Brother Webb, when we were poor and struggling, we had a spiritual church. But he said, now we have a fine building. But he said, the people don't seek the Lord and pray like they used to. Now, it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be the prosperity turns somebody's head. It just doesn't have to be at all. But he said, here's the increase, so they sinned against me. Therefore will I change their glory into shame. They eat up the sin of my people. They set their heart on their iniquity. Then, and there shall be like people, like priests. They will all be alike. I will punish them for their ways and will reward their doings, for they shall eat and not have enough. They shall commit whoredom, that is, they will run after other gods and shall not increase, because they have left off to take heed to the Lord. Notice what takes away the heart, that is, the judgment. Whoredom, wine, and new wine take away the heart. A strong drink is said to take away the heart. There's a statement in Ecclesiastes that I wanted to read. The 7th chapter and the 7th verse, next door to the Song of Solomon. Surely Oppression maketh the wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. Here it would be a bribe. I knew a man that turned in a bid for an electrical job on some homes to a contractor. I knew the contractor. Contractor told me he put two $20 bills in. He said I gave them back to him. Well, notice it takes away the heart. A bribe does, and here new wine. All of this takes away, other words, the judgment. Did you ever see somebody under the influence of liquor to the point that his judgment was impaired? He will drive improperly. He will pay too much for something. He will give away what he shouldn't give away. My people ask counsel at their stocks, and their staff declareth unto them. Now this divining with rods is called rhabdomancy. I believe I can turn to a passage in Ezekiel. I think it's the 21st chapter. I'll call your attention to some of the means that were used. And I may have mentioned it to you, I did in other classes, when Laban said to Jacob, I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake. What he actually said, I've learned by serpents that the Lord blessed me for your sake. And you remember this, what Joseph said. Now, he didn't mean it. He was just getting his brethren in a place where he could deal with them. Speaking of his cup, he said, wist ye not that that is it in which I divine? Now, reading tea leaves and such is practically as old as the human race. In Ezekiel 21, 21st verse, the king of Babylon stood at the parting of the way, at the head of two ways to use divination. He made his arrows bright. He consulted with images. He looked in the liver. Interesting, isn't it? Now here's how they did with their arrows. They would take three arrows and put them on one of them. They would write the name of their God. He commands. That is, God commands. The other one, he doesn't command. The other one, they'd leave blank. They'd put them in here and then they'd draw one out. If it is the blank, they'd draw again. If it said God commands, they would go ahead and attack. If it said God doesn't command, then they would wait. And then when they divined by rods, they would take a rod, a stick, and split the bark off of half of it, and the other half they would leave with the bark on. And they would throw this. When it fell, if the peel side turned up, then that was orders to go ahead. If the bark side came up, that was orders not to go ahead. And then it is stated that he looked in the liver. They would kill an animal, the sheep, and examine the liver for signs. And this is called heptomancy. And then there were the astrologers. You remember the soothsayers, the Chaldeans. You remember the necromancers, those that talked with the dead. Well, Israel fell into all of these things, and here they divined with rods. The 12th verse, again, the Hebrew, Hosea 4. My people ask counsel at their stocks, and their staff declareth unto them, for the spirit of whoredom hath caused them to err, and they've gone whoring from under their God. Now, these things are efforts to obtain knowledge by a way that God hasn't ordained. You remember, in the days of Saul, they didn't inquire of the Ark of the Covenant or of the Lord. And when he got in a pinch, there was a group of people in Israel, unfortunately it became misapplied by the English-speaking people, called a witch, or one that had a familiar spirit. And he inquired of one that had a familiar spirit, and this is one of the things that entered into his death. He was killed for inquiring of one that had a familiar spirit. And there was a man by the name, I believe his name was Casey. He was noted for many years of coming up with answers to things, and he could put himself into a trance at will. And a friend of mine was really impressed with him, and he lent me his book. I didn't read it all, but I said to him, that man had a familiar spirit. One of the great Grecian philosophers had a familiar spirit, a spirit that would talk to him, told him when he was going to die. Some of these things to science is mysterious. You may have read this in Reader's Digest. There was a fellow in one of the South American nations that claimed he was the incarnation of a German doctor that was killed during the war, and his work wasn't finished, and the Lord let him come down to South America to finish it. And some doctors investigated him, and one of them told he had a kind of a wen on his arm, and he let the fellow operate on it. And he said, you just couldn't tell. He just took it out and it was gone, and he just didn't get sore or anything. And another doctor had a wife that was in a totally terminal condition with cancer. He asked him what to do for his wife, and the fellow told him. And he said it was so contrary to medical practice. He said, you can't imagine how I felt giving that dosage to my wife, but he said she got well. And when one of these, get into one of these times, his lingo would change. He would begin to have a German accent in his speech. Well, there are demons. I met a young woman recently. I say some of these people have demonitis. To her, everything's a demon, and I think she has a lot of fun doing what she called casting him out. She's been saved and filled with the Spirit, according to her, but she said the Lord cast the demon out of the wee. He said, I saw it leave. You can scarcely keep from laughing at times when you consider that only John saw demons, and that in a vision. But anyway, the Lord is able to get hold of people and deliver them. But they inquired of their staff. Paul said the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to devils and not to God. You and I are told to resist the devil and he will flee from you. We're not told to fear demons. We're told to resist the devil and all that he represents. They sacrifice upon the tops of the mountains to get as near heaven to the starry host as they could. Burn incense upon the hills and under oaks, much better shade, poplars and poplars and elms, because the shadow thereof is good. Therefore your daughters shall commit whoredom, your spouses shall commit adultery. I will not punish them, he said, for these things. Then he tells why. They themselves are separated. The men themselves carried on worse than their wives and their daughters. Therefore the people doth not understand, they shall fall. It's modesty keeps us from discussing things, but there were both sides of the fence. The Sodomites, the people that are called Sodomites, were devotees, men devoted to religious purposes, unchaste. And one of the reasons that Babylon got the name, excuse the expression, Mother of Harlots, was its practice in its inception. There were women devoted to unchaste purposes in connection with the gods. No wonder God hated those systems. And though Israel play the harlot, yet let not Judah offend, and come not unto Gilgal, neither go to Bethaven. Now Bethaven, God is calling Bethel, Bethaven. Bethel means house of God, but Jeroboam set up a calf there, and God called it Bethaven, which means house of vanity, not house of God. Nor swear, the Lord liveth. God ordained this type of an oath, the Lord liveth, in the law of Moses. But don't swear by a vain thing. Israel slideth back as a backsliding heifer, one that throws off the yoke. Now the Lord will feed them as a lamb in a large place. Now a thing as helpless as a lamb should be in a small place where it can be taken care of. But he says he's just going to turn them loose. Ephraim is joined to his idols, let him alone. It's a sad thing when God says let them alone. Now the disciples said to Jesus one time, thus saying, you offended the Pharisees. He said, leave them alone. They be blind, leaders of the blind. Now there is a hint here that may give a different thought. In the 15th verse, he admonishes Judah not to go to Gilgal, nor swear falsely. That is, don't you have anything to do with Israel? I may have pointed out to you in teaching through the Kings and Chronicles that Judah found the friendship of Israel a far worse thing than they found her enmity. Good Jehoshaphat made the grave mistake of marrying one of his sons to a daughter of Ahab called Athaliah. As Ahab's wife had destroyed the worship of God within her power and set up the worship of Baal, so Athaliah set up the worship of Baal. And now it seems to me the Lord is saying, now don't you have anything to do with them. And he tells why. Israel is backslidden. Ephraim is joined to his idols. Let him alone. You remember this statement, evil communications corrupt good manners. A better translation of that is this, evil companionships corrupt good morals. It's such an interesting thing that two boys, two girls get together. One of them is decent, virtuous. The other one is a scamp. Did you ever know the scamp switch? It goes the other way, doesn't it? Unless the one is a steadfast Christian. So leave them alone. You can view it whichever way you wish. Their drink is sour. They have committed whoredom continually. Her rulers with shame do love. Give ye, that is, gifts. The wind hath bound her up in her wings, and they shall be ashamed because of their sacrifices. Now the fifth chapter. Hear ye this, O priests. Now notice the priests are addressed in this verse. Hearken ye, house of Israel. Give ear, O house of the king. Notice three classes, the priests, the people, and the royal house. Judgment is toward you, and he uses the word because again. You have been a snare on Mizpah and a net spread upon Tabor. These were both mountains. Mizpah means watchtower. Tabor was a mountain west of the Jordan, and this is where the people gathered, I believe, in the days of Deborah when they had war. The revolters are profound to make slaughter. Well, I have been a rebuker of them all. It's probably a slaughter of sacrifices seeking the favor of God, but they're like many of the systems today. I want to pray to God through this image. Now, I've gone through the cathedrals and seen different images, particularly supposedly of the Virgin, and people go through and they'll buy candles and they'll take them over here and put them in front of the Virgin and they'll light the candles. It is actually comical if it weren't so tragic. Can a candle pray? And if it could pray, could that stupid image? Well, I guess the image isn't stupid. It's the people that made it and prayed to it. Could it answer? You know it couldn't, of course. And other things that are interesting here, I'm too worldly and too busy to pray myself, so I'll let my candles pray. There was a Methodist preacher in Weston, and he, a man that I knew quite well, died, and he had the funeral, and I went, and he came out and lit the candles before he started preaching. And the interesting thing, right in that town, mind you, he abandoned his wife in a town of 1,400 people, fell for another young woman and abandoned his wife, but this didn't have any effect. The high school asked him to come up and preach the baccalaureate sermon. Then he married the girl that he fell for, and the Methodist church gave him another church over in another district, one of the type that lights candles. I know Ephraim and Israel is not hid from me. There's a statement in the Psalms, they say in their heart, there is no God. God is not in all their thoughts. Well, there is no such thing as concealing anything from God. When the very hairs of your head are all numbered, and I doubt very much that there's a person here, unless you've been to beauty school or barber college, that could even suggest how many hairs there are on a person's head. I asked a barber one time how many hairs there were normally per square inch on a man's head. Well, God could tell you like that, just like he can tell you about everything else. For now, O Ephraim, thou committest whoredoms, and Israel is defiled. They will not frame their doings to turn unto their God. For the spirit of whoredoms is in the midst of them, and they have not known the Lord. It seems like sometimes that people are just carried along, you would almost say, by a spirit. Now, whether the Lord intended here to say or to speak of a demon, or whether it's just the spirit of the thing, I do not know. But he does mention it. And another thing that is characteristic of the people that are way out, away from the Lord, if you know what I mean, is their pride. I've known people that were proud that they wouldn't call on God in their time of need. I know a man that has seemingly a terminal condition. He sits around on Main Street most of the time. He's not an old man by any means. I would say probably in his 50s. He has a brain tumor that's inoperable, has an apartment upstairs, and I have known him off and on ever since I've been there, and I said to him recently, what are you doing for your soul? Have you turned any thoughts to God? And he didn't say a word. And I said, if you don't object, I'd like to come down and talk to you. And he looked off this way and wouldn't say a word. And he's not going to call on God. You see, this is pride. The same word is in the 10th verse of the 7th chapter. The pride of Israel testifieth to his face. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall, according to Proverbs. The pride of Israel doth testify to his face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity. Judah also shall fall with them. They shall go with their flocks and with their herds to seek the Lord, but they shall not find him. He hath withdrawn himself from them. What a sad situation. I'm going to read Deuteronomy 32:20. This is what God said he would do to them in time. Deuteronomy 32:20. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end shall be. For they are a very froward generation, children in whom is no faith. And today, as a people, his face is hidden. Did you know that Israel, in all of their searchings, have no way to come to God? I tried to talk to a Jew one time, pointing out, you don't have sacrifices and such. Well, the rabbi told him, the scripture speaks of your praise, of Israel's praise, as the calf of their lips, the calves of their lips. Well, they could offer those calves. They could sacrifice those calves of the lips. Well, that's kind of beggaring the situation, isn't it? My, how they would like to actually be in contact with God. How superior they act. One of them said to me, now the Lord is going to use the Gentiles. He has used them to spread the scriptures around. I always like to dig him. I'd say, now, Benjamin, I know your scriptures better than you do, and I did. Dig in on him just for harshness. God's face is hidden from them. They are blinded. God sent them the gospel, and God sent Christ to them, and they turned him down. In that sense, God says, I blinded them. But they rejected him, therefore they are responsible. They have dealt treacherously against the Lord, for they have begotten strange children. Now shall a month devour them with their portions. One, just take a month for them all to disappear, a short time. Blow you the cornet in Gibeah and the trumpet in Ramah, both towns in Benjamin. Cry aloud at Bethaven, that's the house of vanity, after thee, O Benjamin. Evidently, to warn of an invasion. Ephraim shall be desolate in the day of rebuke among the tribes of Israel. Have I made known that which shall surely be? The princes of Judah were like them that remove the bound, that is, the boundary. Let's take just a text or two regarding removing the boundary. Somebody take Deuteronomy 19:14, 27:17, Job 24:2. And there are two in Proverbs right together, 22, 28, and 23, 10. Let's have the passage in Deuteronomy, if you have turned to it. Deuteronomy 7, or 19, 14.
Thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance, which thou shalt inherit in the land that the Lord thy God giveth thee to possess it.
I'll read the one in Deuteronomy 27:17.
Cursed be he who removeth his neighbor's landmark, and all the peoples shall say Amen.
Now read the one in Job.
24:2. Some remove the landmarks, they violently take away flocks and feed them.
No, to read Proverbs 22:28.
He that soweth iniquity shall reap vanity, and the rod of his anger shall fail.
Is that 22:28?
That's 22:28?
Yes, ma'am.
Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set.
Now 23:10.
Remove not the old landmark, and enter not into the fields of the fatherless.
Did you ever see a landmark? You don't see them much anymore. The days when there weren't fences, they would put a big rock or a post, and different people among the Romans, they actually worshiped these. And you see, the advantage was simply this. Here's a line and here's the post. I'm able to set it over here about 40 feet, and my property's on this side, and I have dwindled your possessions, but I've increased mine. If it's quite a ways across there, I have put a lot of timber, a lot of good ground over on my side of the fence. And in our day, many landmarks have been given up in Christendom. When the present Baptist pastor came to Weston, the people who had stood by the church for many years made the statement that he pushed them in the background. And he said from the pulpit, "People say that I'm a liberal, and I'm proud to say that I am." He has given up the ancient landmarks. A Baptist pastor that pastored north of Weston, I remarked to him one time, Baptist people as a whole in the past have believed what they do believe, and he said to me, "The Baptist church is dying from the top." And then he explained to me what he meant. Now I just quote him. He said, "They believe that inspiration." Now I asked a woman to paint a picture one time, to paint a picture of the Lord's Supper like it was. They took the Lord's Supper like leaning down, not sitting up as we do. I asked her to paint a picture of that. She said, "I can't paint without inspiration." Well, he said that they claim that's the way the writers of the Bible were inspired, like you might get inspired to chop down a tree or write a poem or something like this. And that's removing a landmark. We believe that inspiration is when God enabled men to write inerrantly. And giving up the new birth, giving up the necessity of the shed blood. I had a little set to with a preacher in Leavenworth. He said Jesus was the Son of God by adoption. He said Peter taught that, and I said, "Peter doesn't use the word adoption." Well, you see, giving up truths. Jesus wasn't literally the Son of God, but only symbolically so. Notice what Jeremiah said in 6:16. "Thus saith the Lord, stand ye in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where is the good way, and walk therein, and ye shall find rest for your souls." Did you know Jesus' words were a quote? But they said, "We will not walk therein." They removed the ancient landmarks. Well, we'd better pause for a little while.
Yes.
Well, there were two kingdoms, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Now, at this time, Isaiah was prophesying in the southern kingdom. Hosea was prophesying in the northern kingdom. That's where he was, and that's where his prophecy was being given. And since he was preaching to that group, well, of course, he spoke of them more. He spoke of Judah, but he wasn't a prophet to Judah. Like both Elijah and Elisha were prophets to the northern kingdom, and they didn't prophesy in Judah. In these sections, now originally Israel was the whole nation. After they divided, the northern 10 tribes were frequently called Israel, and the southern kingdom, Judah, the kingdom of Judah. And the southern kingdom was made up primarily of Benjamin and Judah, and many people from the northern tribes went to them when they found that God was with them. And in the way the kingdom divided, most of the priestly cities were in the tribe in the Judean area, so they had many of the Levites. But the reason he keeps emphasizing Ephraim is that he was in the northern kingdom, and Ephraim for many years was the dominant tribe. From the tabernacle was set up in the dominion of Ephraim. Joshua was of the tribe of Ephraim, and this gave them a prominent place. And then the man who rebelled and brought about the division, Jeroboam, was an Ephraimite, if I remember correctly. So they were a dominant tribe, and so the northern kingdom came to be called Ephraim. If I remember correctly, it means double fruitfulness. Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. One of them was born. He named him Manasseh because he said, "The Lord hath made me forget all the troubles that he had." Then when Ephraim was born, he said, "The Lord hath made me fruitful in the land of my captivity." He had two sons. Double fruitfulness, I believe, is the meaning of the word. It will be associated with the word fruit some way. "The princes of Judah were like them that removed the bounds. Therefore I will pour out my wrath upon them like water. Ephraim is oppressed and broken in judgment," that is God's judgment, "because he willingly walked after the commandments," probably the commandments of Jeroboam, that made two calves. You see, when Jeroboam took the northern kingdom, he said, "Now will the people return to Judah and Jerusalem." In other words, he would lose his kingdom. So he set up two calves, two idol gods, and he also ordained certain feasts and certain days like the southern kingdom had, only theirs were ordained of God. And he commanded them, it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Worship here, worship. And it's the same system that I mentioned a while ago, to pray to God through an image. Just as logical as for me to pray to that mic or to this pen. Therefore will I be unto Ephraim as a moth, and to the house of Judah as rottenness. Peter Cartwright was an outstanding Methodist preacher in the early days of our country, and he was moving from one state to another, and he camped under a big tree, and unknown to him, the inside of the tree was entirely rotten, and in the night, it fell and killed one of his little girls. They had to bury the sweet little thing and drive off and leave her. What a grief. Rottenness. The moth would eat them up like a moth-eaten garment. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wounds, did they call on the Lord? Ephraim went to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb. Yet could he not heal you nor cure you of your wound. Every time they sent to the heathen for help, it proved to be a snare. They would become indebted to that nation, and then that nation would make them tributaries. I will be unto Ephraim as a lion and as a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear and go away. I will take away, and none shall rescue him. Without guns, a lion was naturally a fearful being, and with guns, a lion is a fearful being. I will go and return to my place till they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. In their affliction, they will seek me early. Jesus said, ye shall see me no more until ye shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Seek my face. I will return to my place. One translator said, they will suffer the penalty of their guilt. Something that I passed over back in the 17th verse, Ephraim joined to his idols. I copied these meanings to this word, joined. It means by means of spells. You heard people talk about a magic spell. To fascinate. Some kind of magic applied to the binding of magical knots, of incantations, and of, well, I could go on and read more, but you can see how they were joined, seemingly by a ceremony. Come and let us return unto the Lord. Not heard much in here, referring really to the future. He hath torn and he will heal us. He hath smitten and he will bind us up. After 2 days will he revive us, and the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live in his sight. I've never been entirely satisfied with what this means. I've heard people apply it to 2,000 years of this day, and the third day would be the 2,000 years of this age. But it doesn't quite satisfy me, and then there would be the second of the 3,000 when they would live. Probably just a short time. Jesus said, tell that fox, I do cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I shall be perfected. Then shall we know if we follow on to know the Lord, his going forth is prepared as the morning, and he shall come unto us as the rain, as the latter rain unto the earth. O Ephraim, what shall I do unto thee? O Judah, what shall I do unto thee? What more could he do than he has done? I'll just read this brief note in the 5th chapter, or a brief statement. It's not a note, it's part of the prophecy of Isaiah, where the Israel is likened to a vine. And he said in the 3rd verse, and now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, you're asking about Ephraim. Now this man is preaching in Judah. Judge, I pray you, betwixt me and my vineyard. What could have been done more to my vineyard that I have not done in it? Wherefore, when I looked that it should bring forth grapes, brought it forth wild grapes. And so now he said, what can I do for you? Your goodness is as a morning cloud, and as the early dew, it goeth away. You've seen a mist perish before the morning sun, and the dew disappear. I know you have. But he said, that's the way your goodness is, Judah and Ephraim. Therefore have I hewed them by the prophets. There is a word in the Old Testament, and I must look it up. It means to hack with words. I have slain them by the words of my mouth, and thy judgments are as the light that goeth forth. For I desired mercy and not sacrifice. One of the things that is vanishing from the earth, we don't need each other like we used to. Now I'll ask you a question. Did you ever go to a neighbor's and borrow matches? We have. You ever go to a neighbor's and borrow kerosene? You live miles from town. You don't have a car. you have a wagon or a buggy, well, I have. You ever go borrow sugar? I have. And I've had people come to us. We don't need those things. I mean, we don't need each other. Less and less do we need each other in an economic sense. And the Lord said, I desire mercy. Why not learn to be kind and generous, not just notice sacrifice? There is such a thing as a formal, cold, dead correctness, like the Pharisees. But he said, you devour widows' houses. I have a book written by a priest, 50 years in the Church of Rome. And then he tells many things, how people were robbed. And he told a missionary friend of mine, I think he's dead now, I haven't heard from him some years, told that the priest, if there was serious illness in the home, the man was ill, he'd go into the home and he'd say, now you may want to make up a will. Let's see, just what do you have? How many head of livestock? How many chickens? How much furniture? How much in the bank? He said the man would know just exactly when to quit praying somebody out of purgatory, because there wasn't anything else to give him. He had it all. And Father Shinicky wrote a book on 50 years in the Church of Rome, too many things along that line. There is an exactness that is merciless. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. In other words, God wants reality. But they, like men, have transgressed the covenant. There have they dealt treacherously against me. Gilead is a city of them that work iniquity. Gilead was an area east of the Jordan and is polluted with blood. Here the Lord likens it to a city. As troops of robbers wait for a man, so the company of priests murder in the way by consent, or they commit lewdness. The Russians have manifested in the last few weeks that to them human life is such a cheap thing. Communism is this: if it doesn't matter who or what or how many they have to kill to advance communism, they're doing the right thing if they do it. They commit lewdness. We read, I have seen a horrible thing. Did you ever think that some things that God counts horrible, we do not count horrible? A horrible thing in the house of Israel, there is the whoredom of Ephraim. Israel is defiled, no doubt spiritual as well as physical, but you think of the millions that worship idols. It's not a horrible thing to them. It's not a horrible thing to the world. The world respects them in it. It's a horrible thing to God. Also, O Judah, he has set an harvest for thee. I take it like this. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. I've set a harvest for thee when I return the captivity of my people. When I would have healed Israel, the seventh chapter, then the iniquity of Ephraim was discovered. This word means to denude. It means to strip or uncover. Their iniquity was brought to light. The wickedness of Samaria, for they commit falsehood, and the thief cometh in, the truth robbers spoileth without. The thief cometh in, that is, he robs the inside of the house. It's become, to me, a national disgrace, and you can't defend yourself. I think the laws that we have. If a man steals my car and takes off with it and I shoot him, the state will arrest me and his relatives can sue me and do it legally. These things are sad to me. A man out in Colorado, some boys were wrecking his tractor. He roughed them up a little bit and was arrested for it. They make the king, well, the second verse, they consider not in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their own doings have beset them about. They are before my face. The backslider compassed about with his own ways. I will read a verse in the first chapter of Proverbs that always stands out to me. The 31st verse of the first chapter of Proverbs reads like this. Therefore shall they eat the fruit of their own way and be filled with their own devices. Now their own doings have beset them about. They are before my face. One of the sad things in life is to have to see people reap. When you get a little older, well, I tried to warn a fellow one time about a marriage that he was making. Do you know what he did? Laughed at me. A Christian man wanted to become a minister and did become a minister. I think it was one of the most miserable marriages I ever saw. One of my friends said to a girl one time who was getting married, he said, well, love may be blind, but it doesn't have to be dumb. That was also a very miserable marriage. So you can see people reaping what they have sown. A girl meets a young man, he will show an interest in the things of God. As one man said, somebody said, "You're kind of turning Pentecost, aren't you?" And the young man said, "I have to till I get that girl." And he got the girl. He abandoned her with four children, married another girl, had five more children. She was the first Pentecostal person that I ever knew. I was just a child then. So we dislike and we get in and help them. We're sorry for people that reap what they sow. I know I made a mistake and they need help and we give it. How blind we can be at times in life. They make the king glad with their wickedness and the princes with their lies. In other words, the leaders were just like the people. They're all adulterers as an oven heated by the baker, who ceaseth from raising after he hath kneaded the dough until it be leavened, but he has the oven ready. The day of our king, the princes have made him sick with bottles of wine, not simply glasses, but bottles. When I was in Germany, I saw a wine cask in a castle, a king's castle. Had been a king's castle. There was a pamphlet to pick up, and I did. To give you an idea of its size, I did know how much it held. It took 186 oak trees to make that barrel. You can imagine how big it was. He had the wine piped to all parts of his castle. I expect he was a wino. It made him mad as a hornet, I expect, if you told him, but that's what he was. I can say it now, he's dead. They've made their heart ready like an oven. When they lie in wait, their baker sleepeth all the night. In the morning it burneth as a flaming fire. In the morning, well, the leaven here is never used in a good sense. Leaven never is used in a good sense. You hear people talk about the leaven of the gospel. There is no such thing. When it's used symbolically, it's used in an evil sense. They're all hot as an oven to do evil, of course. There is none among them that calleth unto me. Now weigh that for a moment. The Lord said to Noah, and can you imagine that with possibly 100 million people in the world, thee only have I seen righteous before me. That sounds impossible, doesn't it? But that's the way it was. And here the Lord said, there's none among them that calleth unto me. Ephraim hath mixed himself among the people. Now, we can't get out of the world, but we're not of the world. And Israel was to dwell separately and dwell alone, Balaam was made to say, but they mixed themselves among the people, and this was their downfall. Ephraim is a cake not turned. Now we have ovens that provide heat above and below at the same time. They cook their bread many times by putting it on the coals or some such manner, and they turned it ever so often to keep it from burning. But evidently it's a figure of a woman that forgot. Burned on one side, dough on the other. Incidentally, isn't dough a hard thing to try to eat? You ever try to eat half raw bread? Now in this context that we read earlier, you will remember, that the Lord said they were like a backslidden heifer. They were like a drunkard. Wine taketh away the heart. They were like robbers and like thieves. We just read they're like a leavened mass of dough. They're like a cake unturned. In this chapter, we read they're like a silly dove. They're like a deceitful bowl, of course, that cannot hit the mark. And in chapter 8, like a vessel in which is no pleasure. Well, the Lord wanted them separated, they wouldn't be separated. A cake not turned. Strangers have devoured his strength. He knoweth it not. Yea, gray hairs are here and there upon him, yet he knoweth it not. We read in the book of Ecclesiastes of a king that will no longer be admonished. I know it all. You don't need to try to tell me. I know all about it. And people don't know many times that they're slipping. I said to a man the other day, "You're slipping." He said, "I know it better than you do." Well, gray hairs are here and there. This is a sign that the body, the system is weakening, wearing out, but Ephraim didn't know it. People like to think of what they used to be, like to think they still are. They're not. The body begins to fail very early. The pride of Israel testifieth to his face, and they do not return to the Lord their God, nor seek him for all this. Sad thing, isn't it? The 16th verse says, they return, but not to the Most High. Ephraim is like a silly dove without heart. They call to Egypt, they go to Assyria. In their need, they didn't turn to the Lord. They went to the heathen nations. You take this statement, therefore have I cried concerning this, their strength is to sit still. I've heard that preached on, and with just a kind of a sinking feeling inside of me. What was happening was, and go to it in the book of Isaiah, I believe, Israel was scared, and they were sending to Egypt for help. And Isaiah was saying, in essence, don't do this. Your strength is to sit still. And I've heard people preach on it so much. Just be still. Just stay still. Well, that isn't the meaning. You may make that application if you want to, but Isaiah was trying to keep them from going down into Egypt. And how good would it be if we do learn to rely on the Lord? How many of you ever heard of George Mueller? Some of you have, of Bristol, England. He had an orphanage. It finally developed into 2,000 orphans. He didn't take offerings for it. He had no solicitors. He had nobody out rounding up funds. He was a man of faith. I read his whole book some years ago, but the other day I was reading just a little statement that was interesting. This writer said he met a captain on a ship, and he told him, he said, I had an experience that changed my whole Christian life. He said there was a man on board going from England to Canada, and he said, I had been on the deck for 22 hours because there was a fog that you could cut with a knife. And he said, if somebody tapped me on the shoulder and said, Captain, I have to be in Quebec by Saturday. And he said, sir, it's impossible. He said, well, God made the appointment for me, and he said, I've known the Lord 57 years, and he said, he has never failed me yet. He said, let's go pray. And he said, I thought, what kind of an asylum, a mental institution, did he escape from? But he said he went with him, and he said the fellow prayed and said, Lord, you know I'm supposed to be there at a given time, and I ask you to take this fog away. And he said, I thought to myself, now that's the kind of a prayer an 8 or 10 year old child would make. And he said, I started to pray and said, he put his hand on my shoulder and said, now don't pray. First off, because you don't believe God. Second, you open the door and the fog will be gone. They had been there 5 minutes, and he said, I opened the door and there wasn't a bit of fog. He said he was at his appointment on Saturday. Well, that was turning to the Lord. It was an impossible situation. I used to conduct Bible studies out here on Tuesday nights where David pastors now. We just had a cottage prayer meeting then. And I got out in the car one night, and here's how bad the fog was. I had to drive over where I could see the curb, car lights. I couldn't see out there at all. I went around the block and came back. Well, what a marvelous thing it was. He turned to the Lord. He never did know how this came about. The man that did it requested that he not know it, but a man went to visit him. The man related this. He said he asked me to pray. This was at night. And he said, we don't have one thing in this establishment for breakfast. Not a thing. And he said, I looked at him and said, but sir, every store in town is closed. Well, he said, we've carried on these many years and we've never missed a meal. And the Lord got a man out of bed, and he supplied food for breakfast and for some days to come for 2,000 orphans, and requested that they never tell the story until Mr. Mueller was dead. Well, he knew how to trust God. The Lord said, now, they'll go, but when they go, I'll spread my net upon them like the silly dove. I will bring them down as the fowls of the heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation hath heard. Woe unto them, for they have fled from me. The safest place for any human being in your experience is close to the Lord. Destruction unto them. Wouldn't you hate for God to say that about you or to you? And then he tells why, because they have transgressed against me, though I have redeemed them, yet they have spoken lies against me. They have not cried unto me with their heart when they howled upon their beds. Notice they yelled so much they were howling on their beds, but they didn't cry to the Lord with their hearts. They were just making a noise. They assembled themselves for corn and wine. That is, they appealed to their gods, but they rebelled against God. Though I have bound and strengthened their arms, yet do they imagine mischief against me. They return but not to the Most High. They are like a deceitful bull. Of course, can't hit the mark with a deceitful bull. Their princes shall fall by the sword for the rage of their tongue. This shall be their derision in the land of Egypt. And in the days of Jeremiah, quite a few of the Judahites and others with them went into the land of Egypt. Set the trumpet to thy mouth. That is, there's going to be an invasion. The trumpet was to be used to warn of war. He shall come as an eagle against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and trespassed against my law. Israel shall cry unto me, My God, we know thee, but they didn't. Remember Matthew 7, in that day many will say unto me, Well, Lord, haven't we preached in your name, and you preached in our streets? In your name we have cast out devils, and he'll say, Depart from me, I never knew you. Aren't there going to be a lot of people surprised? I read somebody's imaginative story. Maybe he actually did have a concept from the Lord. I don't remember the details, but supposedly after the translation, people turned on their preachers and stoned them because they hadn't told them the truth. They have transgressed my covenant, trespassed against me. Israel shall cry, My God, we know thee. Israel hath cast off the thing that is good. The enemy shall pursue him. Man's greatest benefit is to seek the Lord. They have set up kings, but not by me. Read the history of Israel, the northern kingdom, and their kings. 19 kings after the kingdom was divided, not one godly man among them. Remember Ahab? What a character he was. He was a king of the northern kingdom. Omri, his father, I believe it was his father, preceded him, and he was a very wicked king. They have made princes, and I knew it not. Of their silver and their gold have they made them idols, that they may be cut off. Thy calf, O Samaria, has cast thee off. Mine anger is kindled against them. How long will it be ere they attain to innocency? Do you marvel at God's patience, his long suffering? How long would you bear with the world if you had it in your hands to take care of it? How long would you put up with the ungodliness, the persecution of the missionaries? What would you do if you sent a missionary and you had the power to do something about it? He was thrown out of the land or killed. I've known people that had to leave the country where they were ministering. We had three missionaries speak at the Bible school one time from Ethiopia. That was after Mussolini had invaded Ethiopia in the 30s. This was in the 40s. I knew a man and his wife that were forced out of Colombia, South America. This calf that he speaks of, he said, it's the workman made it, therefore it is not God. But the calf of Samaria shall be broken in pieces. They have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. So much said about this in the scriptures I quoted a moment ago from Galatians 6. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. The bud shall yield no meal, or if it yield, a stranger shall swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up. Now shall he be among the Gentiles, or they be among the Gentiles, as a vessel wherein is no pleasure. God let the king of Assyria take them captive, approximately 120 years before Nebuchadnezzar overthrew Jerusalem. They're going up to Assyria, a wild ass alone, by himself. Israel hath hired lovers. Yea, though they have hired among the nations, now will I gather them, and they shall sorrow a little for the burden of the king of princes. I might call your attention to, I believe it's Ezekiel 26:7, where Nebuchadnezzar is called this title in essence. Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I will bring upon Tyrus Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, a king of kings from the north, with horses and chariots and horsemen and companies and much people. He eventually had all of them under his thumb. Yea, though they have hired among the nations, now will I gather them. They shall sorrow a little for the burden of the king of princes. Because Ephraim hath made many altars to sin, altars shall be unto him to sin. Now this is not Ephraim, this is Judah that I'm going to read about. In the 33rd chapter of 2 Chronicles, I'm going to read two or three verses in this context and let you see what men did when they went away from God. You think sometimes of Athens, when Paul went there, you remember there was an altar to the unknown God. We know lots of gods, but we don't want to miss any of them. In the third verse of 2 Chronicles 13, he built again the high places, this is Manasseh, which Hezekiah his father had broken down. He reared up altars for Balaam. He made groves and worshipped all the host of heaven. In the fourth verse, he built altars in the house of the Lord. The fifth verse, he built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. And then notice what another king did in 2 Kings 16:9. This is kind of a sad story. This man had sent a heathen king to come and help him. And the man had come, and he went up to meet him. In the ninth verse of 2 Kings 16, the king of Assyria hearkened unto him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus and took it, and carried the people of it captive to Kir, and slew Rezin. Rezin was the king. King Ahaz, this is one of the kings during the reign of Hosea, went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the fashion of the altar and the pattern of it according to all the workmanship thereof. Urijah the priest built an altar according to all this. And the 12th verse, when the king was come from Damascus, the king saw the altar. The king approached the altar and offered thereon. And he burnt his burnt offerings and his meat offerings, and he poured his drink offerings and sprinkled his blood of his peace offerings upon the altar. He brought also the brazen altar. Now, this was the Lord's altar. This was before the Lord, from the forefront of the house, from between the altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of the altar. Well, I just wanted you to see that they made altars and altars and altars. And he said, altars shall be unto him to sin. I've written to him the great things of my law. This word great things is the word that's translated myriads, means myriads, sometimes translated 10,000. So the Lord could say, I have said to him the 10,000 things of my law, but they were counted as a strange thing. I wonder if I can turn to the passage where the king burned the book that Jeremiah had written. That to you the other night. I believe that's in the 36th chapter of Jeremiah. Jeremiah had Baruch write these, and he took them to the princes, the 14th verse, and read them to them. The 16th verse says, now it came to pass when they had heard all these words, they were afraid, both one and another, and they said unto Baruch, we will surely tell the king all these words. So they asked Baruch, saying, tell us, how didst thou write it? And then he told them the 18th verse, he pronounced all these words unto me with his mouth. That was Jeremiah, and I wrote them with ink in the book. The princes said, go hide thee, thou and Jeremiah, and let no man know where ye be. They went and told the king. So the king sent Jehudi to fetch the book. He took out of Elishama, the scribe's chamber, and Jehudi read it in the ears of the king. Now notice the 22nd verse. The king sat in the winter house in the ninth month. There was a fire on the hearth burning before him. Came to pass that when Jehudi had read three or four leaves, he cut it with pen knife. Now this is the only time the pen knife occurs in the scriptures, but it was a little knife that they used to keep their quill sharp, pen knife, to sharpen the pen with, that they wrote with. And he cast it into the fire that was on the hearth until all the roll was consumed in the fire that was on the hearth. Yet they were not afraid, nor rent their garments, neither the king nor any of his servants had heard all these words. And he counted the words as strange. Notice the judgment God predicted against him. As a result of this, in the 30th verse, he shall have none to sit upon the throne of David, and his dead body shall be cast out in the day to the heat, and in the night to the frost, and I will punish him and his seed and his servants for their iniquity, so on. But anyway, God wrote to them the great things of his law, but they seemed strange to them. One time in the days of Josiah, they were cleaning out the temple, and they found the law of God. It had been used in Siloam. They had forgotten it was there. I trust that you will wear out your Bible and then wear out another one and then wear out another one. I like to see a worn-out Bible. They sacrifice flesh for the sacrifice of mine offerings and eat it. That was the way they were told to do with the peace offering. But the Lord accepteth them not. Now will he remember their iniquity and visit their sins. They shall return to Egypt. Let's go for just a moment to the first chapter of Isaiah. You have read it many times, I'm sure. And I want you to see the emptiness of the sacrifices. They had become such an empty thing that here is what God said in the 12th verse. Well, let's read the 11th. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me? Saith the Lord, I am full of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts, and I delight not in the blood of bullocks or of lambs or of he-goats. When you come to appear before me, who hath required this at your hand to tread my courts? Bring no more vain oblations. This is where their trouble was. They were empty. Incense is an abomination unto me. The new moons and the Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies. I cannot away with it. It is iniquity, even the solemn meetings. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hateth. They are a trouble unto me. I am weary to bear them. And when you spread forth your hands, I will hide mine eyes from you. When you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Wash you, make you clean, put away the evil. Well, he uses this terribly dark background to say, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. But I want you to see that in the time of Hosea and Isaiah preaching at the same time, one in the northern kingdom, one in the southern kingdom, that their message was very similar. Israel hath forgotten his maker. Now, I have read in this book, and I read to you in the Psalms last week, about how Israel forgot and how quickly we forget. How so quickly we forget. Buildeth temples, this is idol temples, and Judah hath multiplied fenced cities. But I will send a fire upon his cities, and it shall devour the palaces thereof.